It's the Faith Connection Show, and it's here to help you grow. It's the Faith Connection Show, and it's here to help you grow. Here we go, here we go, here we go. Here we go, here we go, here we go. It's the Faith Connection Show. It's the Faith Connection Show. It's giving you motivation, inspiration, revelation. It's giving you motivation, inspiration, revelation. It's the Faith Connection. Here we go, here we go, here we go.
Here we go, here we go, here we go. Here's an inspirational word from Dr. David Miller before the show begins.
Do not become discouraged by the naysayers of life who are telling you that you can't do certain things, because you know what? You can do anything you desire to do. The greatest pleasure in life is doing what people say you cannot do. Follow your dream and do what you have been blessed to do.
It's the Faith Connection.
We're in the studio today with Bryant Walker, a young man that has a fantastic story to tell. And not only that, we're going to make the connection with how he overcame certain obstacles and had a tremendous change of mind and heart that put him in a position to own his own company. And, you know, we're just excited, Brian, to have you here. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Brian, and then we're going to talk about some of these great accomplishments you've made.
Yeah, so I'm 29. I'm pretty much from Charlotte. I've been here since 93. My dad came down here with Nations Bank. I'll let you know how old that was. But I'm married. Just had a daughter. She just turned one, and now she's walking and climbing upstairs and doing everything now.
That's a great season, isn't it?
Yeah, repeating everything you do. Yeah, like you were, you know, alluding to, I own my own media marketing services company. So we help a lot of companies with video production for commercials, and then we actually advertise it online.
That's great, Brian. But, you know, I really wanted Brian's story on our show because, you know, Brian has a tremendous story. Brian, let's start back, roll back just a bit and talk about how you got to this point, because I think it was somewhat of a little struggle and a readjustment of attitude and some other things that helped you to get there. And, you know, we're dealing with a lot of young people out there who could really learn and be blessed by your story, because there are a lot of them that are searching and don't really know where or what. You came from a very successful household, your father in banking, and your mom, both of them had good careers. And my understanding is you were skateboarding, is that right?
Yeah, pretty close, pretty close.
All right, tell us about it.
So back in 2000, when I was 10, I got a Razor scooter for Christmas.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to skateboard or bike, but my mom always saw like X Games and people breaking arms. So I got a scooter for Christmas. Pretty much from that, you know, I started doing tricks and all that type of stuff. So I kind of became a part of skate culture, but I can do like backflips and all the crazy stuff on a scooter.
Okay. Now, what happened was, is that culture was altogether different than where you are now. What you had gotten to a point where you had your own website or page. Tell me a little bit about that.
Right. So, you know, with that, you know, community and all that type of stuff, I would go on the internet. This is in the early 2000s, and I connect with other people and skateboarders and whatnot. And I used to upload all my videos to YouTube, and one of them went viral, and it got like 100,000 views, you know. And even though I wasn't really that popular in school, I was popular on the internet in this little community of people because I was really good at what I did. So I had this little website and this little community, and we'd share videos and stuff. And I think the coolest thing that came out of it is I got some free, I got sponsored and got some free scooters, and I ended up in a magazine in France for scootering.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, now, but at that time, you sort of neglected your studies for the purpose of fame, huh?
Yeah, internet fame, I guess, before Instagram and MySpace and all that. So, yeah, that was my focus. I mean, in school, you know, up until that point, you know, especially first 2 years, freshman year and sophomore year, it's just kind of like I was like a C student, just kind of going through it. You know, it wasn't that I wasn't like the things were too hard, but I wasn't motivated, to say the least. I didn't get too excited from the classes.
Okay, now tell me a little bit about what turned, what made the turnaround. I mean, what took you from just a C student mm-hmm. to an honor student?
Yeah, so I would say the biggest thing is I went to my guidance counselor. I think my mom had pushed me. She's like, go to the guidance counselor and, you know, stay on track. You got to stay on track. You got to stay on track. And eventually I was like, all right, I'll go. Let me see. And I went to my guidance counselor and she was like, you know, what do you want to do with your, you know, career? What are you interested in? And I was like, I told her like graphic design and these things. And I was like, you know, I want to go to college. And she, you know, looked at my grades. She looked at my, you know, portfolio and everything. And she's like, well, you know, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe you can get into an HBCU or like her tone was weird. It was kind of like, you know, maybe not the college you're thinking, because I had listed like, oh, maybe like a UNC, or my brother was going to NC State. You know, like she's like, yeah, well, you know, for you to do that, you're going to have to get honor roll for the last like 2 years of your high school career. And it just felt like a challenge to me. Like it was like, you know, I don't believe you can do it. Hey, here's a plan B type option. Because, you know, you look pretty average. And that was like I was like, that's not me. I'm not average, you know.
So what happened from that point? Did you take the challenge?
Yeah, I took it personally. It was like, like if I didn't have a goal or a purpose before then, mm-hmm. it was like, I want to make sure that she sees like, man, like I'm excellent, you know. So like it wasn't just about the grades. It was just like, I'm not even representing like my best self, so to speak. You know what I mean? Like, I know how smart I am and all that type of stuff. But like on paper, she was like, well, I don't see it. So every semester, you know, every quarter, because I'm thinking semester because I think about college, but every quarter, you know, I got honor roll, you
my
know,
goodness.
And that was like my motivation. And I learned like the reason why I even like scooter or anything is like somebody wanted to be the first to do this trick. Mm-hmm. So with this was a new challenge for somebody saying, I bet you can't do this. And I was like, oh, a word. Okay.
My goodness. And then you went to college, though.
Right.
Where did you go?
I went to UNC Greensboro.
Okay. And evidently you did pretty well in college because mm-hmm. you got a degree in.
Yeah, I got a degree in business administration.
Right. And now you own your own business.
Right. Yeah.
And your company is called Ninth Avenue Media. Tell me a little bit about what the company does.
Right. So what I noticed is in order to run a business, I had to solve some type of problem. And the thing is, you know, nowadays people are on their phones all the time. And I wanted to help business owners get in front of those people online. So the best way to do that is with my background from scootering and all that, I actually learned how to do video and editing and all that. And I had been building up that skill set. So I do video production, like commercials for businesses, and then I help them market it online using Facebook and YouTube.
Now, you taught yourself to do that when you were marketing your scooter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
skills
how I kind of started.
On the internet. Huh?
Yeah, I kind of also say I have a degree in YouTube. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, and you've built a fairly successful business over the mm-hmm. past few years. How long have you been in business now for yourself?
I would say like legit 1 year.
1 year?
Yeah.
Okay, but you know, it looks like you've worked for some major companies on your way to your own business, and mm-hmm. and it seems like that all of that sort of paid off for you. Now, I looked at your resume, and your resume talks about various areas. I mean, even music production, and I'm going to mm-hmm. get to that. But I'm just anxious to talk to you about some of the other things that you've done. You've also been an IT client, a senior recruiter. Mm-hmm. You've done things such as Facebook advertising specialist. Mm-hmm. And all of these things have brought you to this point that you could use all of the skills from scootering mm-hmm. all the way up to Ninth Avenue Media.
Mm-hmm.
That is fantastic. And you were voted most likely not to succeed. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. If it was the way my guidance counselor saw it when I was a sophomore, mm-hmm. I probably, if she didn't challenge me, to be honest, I think I probably would have just graduated a C student. You know what I mean?
My goodness, yeah.
And that was like that moment where I was like, that was like a shift, you know?
What would you say to another young person who has an interest in something that may not be a career move, but mm-hmm. they're neglecting the basic things that they need to do in order to solidify a real great career for themselves. What would you say to a young person who was where you were?
I mean, it's two things for me. I mean, the first thing is, like, even though I was passionate, I was scootering and all that, and that doesn't show like a specific skill set, it did show me that I did like challenges, and it did show me that I did like being creative. And it's like, look at the things that you enjoy right now. I don't know if it's your, you know, people are pro video game players and stuff. I mean, there's so many things now. There's people who are social media influencers. But think about the ways how, you know, you can use that skill set, you know, to like the business aspects of it. You know, like, how can you help people, you know, with what you're doing? Do you have a big audience? You know, maybe you can help somebody get awareness about their company or service or something, or just, you know, don't think of it just as a hobby, but think about, like, what am I really doing? And then the second piece is, if it is just a hobby, like if I was just, you know, scootering and it wasn't even an endpoint, what the guidance counselor piece really was showing me is there's windows. I don't care what stage of life you're in, if you're elementary, middle school, high school, college, everybody is going through, there's windows of opportunity. And you have to capitalize on those windows of opportunity. Otherwise, when you get older, you're going to look back and be like, man, how did I miss out on this opportunity? So I would say to you, this is something my dad told me. He said, if like when I was 18, I think he told me this, but he was like, act like you're 28. He said, do you think you're smarter at 18 than you were when you were 8? I said, of course. He said, well, why don't you act like you're 28 now and think about all the things you wish you would have done now? And I was like, dang. but it was like, it helped me see, like, man, what am I missing out on? What are some opportunities? And for me in high school, it was like, that was my only window. Those 2 years of school were my only window to get into college. Right. You know what I mean? So Had I not taken that window of opportunity, I would have missed out on going to college, you know, that I wanted to go to and get my degree.
Sounds like you made the right choice, Brian. We're going to take a break here, and we're going to make a connection with a great song by Todd Delaney, Your Great Name. Okay, we're back with Bryant Walker, the owner of Ninth Avenue Media. Name some of the major companies that you've worked with.
So I've worked with Goodwill of the Southern Piedmont. So that's the Goodwills for the North and South Carolina area. I've worked with the Women's Business Center Charlotte here, as well as Fifth Third Bank, you know, filming some of their training. So there's a huge referral networking organization called BNI. I mean, they have networking groups for professionals all over the country. It's international. I've worked with them. And even right before I had started doing it, I had done some work with Wake Forest, the business school downtown here in Charlotte, right, and a PNC Bank for some webinar videos. So
now, are some of those your clients now too?
Okay. Goodwill is the current client. You know, Fifth Third is the current client that I've been working with them to help promote some videos. They actually have those out. So, you know, and then I also have, again, the some of the smaller business, like, you know, I have a closing attorney client. I have a guy who's building tiny house communities out here. So, okay, you know, really it's a mix of some majors and some local business owners to help them grow as well.
Fantastic. You know, you have made a major contribution to the community. I mean, and just sitting here talking to you says to me that you are sort of a role model for a lot of young men who are looking to find that center focus in mm-hmm. their lives. And I just want to commend you for what you've done. Let me ask you a little bit about, because, you know, I'm sort of computer literate, so I won't know all of the questions to ask you about it. Yeah. But tell me a little bit about how you are able to work in the internet and Facebook and all of this stuff to really promote your client base. How do you do that?
Is it more so like, kind of like, how does it work, or how did I get into this space? Or
yeah, how does it work?
Okay, really? So basically, every time you get on Google, this is going to scare some people. So, but I mean, it makes sense. So you guys ever go to Amazon and you click a pillow, right? Mm-hmm. You click a pillow, you don't buy the pillow, then you go to another website, but then you see an ad for that pillow, and you're like, how did that? I'm on this whole completely different website. Like, I'm on this news website. How's this pillow popping up? Well, basically, I understand that same type of logic. Like, basically, since I grew up on the internet, every time you do something on Google or every time you do something on Facebook or YouTube, it's any website, Amazon, there's data that's collected, right? So, you know, when you log in, you have a profile, you know, there's information that you give, there's pages you look at. And what these digital marketing platforms or what these advertising platforms allow you to do is, say you're into auto racing. Say you're really into NASCAR for something on YouTube, right? Mm-hmm. I can run ads in front of videos that are NASCAR videos. Like, you never watch a video on YouTube and it has a little ad that comes up right before you watch it and it says skip in 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. I can put your company in front of the things that your audience is looking for.
Oh, okay.
Right. So that's why it's really relevant to people. So I can target people who are, say they're into bass fishing, and they're looking at a specific bass fishing pole. Well, if you sell bass fishing poles, I'd be like, hey, guys, check this out before you watch this video. Yeah. And I could put your video right in front of it. And that's how I essentially help clients get sales. And you can do the same type of stuff on a Facebook or Instagram, too.
Unbelievable. You know, every time I look at a video, I see that on YouTube. And sometimes I skip through them and then sometimes I click them. So, if it's something I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. So there's got to be millions of people out there every day that plug into videos and then end up also tagging mm-hmm. the advertisement that's on there. That's great. Now, tell me a little bit about music production. You're also doing music production.
Right. So I've always been pretty creative. A little fun fact, when I was like in first grade, I had my painting in the library downtown.
Oh, really?
Yeah, drew some seagulls. I guess they were really good. but you know, I've always been in creative things. And when I was like, this is also like at the tail end of high school, I started making beats in this program called FL Studio. And from all the internet stuff I had learned, I created my own website. And there was this community called SoundClick, and I started making beats and collaborating with other music producers, kind of same like with the Scooter stuff. Mm-hmm. But I was a little bit more focused. This is kind of funny because my dad challenged me, and he was like, you know, focus on school. I don't want you to lose track. But I was like, I'm going to learn how to make money doing this.
Uh-huh.
So I got into the music production thing. I started making music and all that. And there was a guy, he was selling beats, and he was doing these things like selling leases. So he would lease out an MP3 of his instrumentals for like $25. So in college, I started making like $1,000 to $2,000 a month selling beats on the internet.
Really?
Yeah. So I started making beats in my dorm room, and I built up my name, and my name was Concept Beats with a K. And I ended up getting like 1 million page views and 10 million song plays. And I just wanted to make beats for fun, but then I learned like, wow, I can sell these to people. And all that stuff I learned on YouTube, I would make videos on YouTube. So I made a video and that went viral of me making a beat. So I noticed that that would help me get more sales. So this little path of like, wow, doing videos with scooters and now doing videos for music and people would buy it. Long story short, labels started reaching out to me.
Really?
Artists started reaching out to me because they're
major
like...
Major labels? Labels?
Right. Right. I had A&Rs from Def Jam reaching out to me because they're like, my artists, like I would let people download my music for free and I would tag it with the tag that was like, what is music without a concept? Like every 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. So then they have to pay me $25 for me to remove the vocal tag off of it. And then if they wanted to buy it outright, it'd be like $500. So like, long story short, I think the cool thing about it was... I didn't know I was doing marketing. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. I thought I was just, you know, selling beats. But long story short, this guy came up and it was this label at the time called EMI. It was like the label for songwriters. Mm-hmm. All these people were writing to my songs at this label. And this dude, my manager, hit me up and I ended up getting a publishing deal with Universal Records.
Are you kidding?
Right. So
do you still produce music?
I did that for them for like about 4 years, and then I finished that like contract out and all that. So that was like when I was like 22. So that was like at the tail end of my college career. So that was while I was still in college. But I still do it. I just don't do it for the label anymore. But I mean, I learned a whole bunch of stuff, and you know, it kind of went into like why I even started Ninth Avenue Media, because I really understand the media side, but then I understood the business side of like, you know, royalties and stuff like that.
Man, God knows. I tell you, you've done an awful lot for 29 years old, you know, and it sounds like you just have a natural gift for entrepreneurship. And are you teaching any classes for young men, seminars or anything like
that? Yeah. So are you familiar with the website meetup.com at all?
No.
Right. So there's this website called meetup.com where you can go find different things based off your interests. So if you're interested in tennis, they'll have like a Charlotte tennis meetup. So I run 3 meetups on meetup.com. I run the Charlotte music production meetup. So that has over 200 music producers in it in Charlotte, because most of us are bedroom producers.
Okay.
So that's how I found out a way to connect. I run the Charlotte video production meetup where you can learn about video production and that aspect of things. And then I run the Charlotte marketing meetup. So if people want to learn more about marketing, like I just did a workshop teaching people how to use YouTube for their businesses, because a lot of times people think YouTube is for cat videos and baby videos and stuff, but you can actually use YouTube to promote your business and actually get traffic to your website. So, you know, those are 3 main ways. And there was actually a high school I got to speak at, Hopewell, to the kids. About marketing and whatnot. So that was pretty cool too.
My grandson is a student at Hopewell.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He loves that. He's in the band.
Okay. Music.
Yeah. He's in the band. He loves music since he was just a little tiny. He just loves music. Can't help it. Now, you know, before we actually close out, because this is so interesting, I wanted to just give you a moment. Because I know your company is starting out, is doing very well, but somebody out there wants to know, how do they contact your company and how do they get a bid or a proposal to help them promote their company? So how would they contact you?
Yeah, so it's as simple. You can go to ninthavenuemedia.com. So it's the number 9th, avenuemedia.com. Basically, you can check out all the work that we've done with different clients and whatnot. And then there's a button there where you can click to like schedule an appointment with me or one of the people on my team. My email contact is on there as well. And then even my phone number for, you know, personal business is on there as well. But yeah, definitely check out 9thavenuemedia.com.
Now, you said one of the members of your team, are these employees that work for you or people that venture with?
Okay. Yeah, so I work with contractors a lot. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so I work with a contract team, so I have like a virtual assistant.
Oh, okay. Good enough. Well, man, I wish that more people had the drive that you have, because it seems like to me you are really driven And that's what it takes to succeed, mm-hmm. to be driven. And that's the reason I really wanted you on the show, because there are so many young people that need to be inspired by young people such as yourself. I mean, to see where you came from. I mean, you weren't doing bad as a scooter promoter, but I think what you've done here to simply reverse your academics based on a challenge, and then after that to graduate college, and then to become a music producer and sign a major contract with
Universal.
Yeah. I mean, that's quite an accomplishment. You know, if you were to stop right where you are now, you could say that you've done some magnificent things. Because were you not also, I think I heard you earlier say that your scooter.
Doing like tricks and stuff like that?
Yeah, yeah. That it was in a French magazine?
So I've been a part of that community so long. So since I started, I became like one of the quote-unquote legends of the sport.
Oh, really?
If anybody doesn't believe me, if you type in Bryant Walker in scooter flip in YouTube, you'll see that viral video. I got a full feature in a magazine in France because they wanted to see like how did I invent some of these tricks that a lot of other people try and stuff.
And I should ask you more about those tricks so we could have included those a little tighter in there, but whole point is, what kind of tricks were you doing?
The cool thing is like a lot of times we were making up our own tricks. So like, you know how people can do like a backflip on a bike? You can do a backflip mm-hmm. on a scooter. You know, you can grind on a handrail or a rail mm-hmm. On a bike or a skateboard. You can do that on a scooter. So if you check that out on YouTube, you'll get lost for hours on all the crazy things kids are doing nowadays. Yeah.
And you were one of the initial.
Yeah, I was on I didn't know it. It was just something I enjoyed doing, but it ended up becoming like, oh my God, like he created this trick. That's cool. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
I guess
it kind of goes to show like I got made fun of it in school. Uh-huh. I wasn't popular for it in school, but. The thing is as an adult now, when people tell me, or even in college, you know, I brought my scooter back out in college, you're like, oh my gosh, like, you know how to do all this? And it was just like, after I brought my scooter out around people, like, I noticed they would be themselves.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's like, also, like, at the same time, like, embrace, like, don't hide the things that you enjoy, even if it's something a little different than what everybody else is. You know what I mean? Because I would have missed all that.
Be your own person.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's important. All right. Well, Brian, it's been great having you on the show. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for consenting to come on because, man, I don't know. I think this is one of the best shows we've done. I think to have someone who has made a real connection in life and now you're passing it on through so many different ways.
Yeah.
So God bless. I hope you continue the work, and I'm really rooting for your company. You're going to have a great, successful company. It seems like you already got the right players.
Yeah. I wanted to say there's a free resource for anybody that I wish I would have had when I was a kid. It's provided by the library if you live in Mecklenburg County. It's a website called lynda.com, mm-hmm. LYNDA.com. And you can learn anything from video production, music production, how to program, how to code, all that stuff. It's free if you have a library card.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I know I tell a lot of teenagers or kids and stuff about it, and it's like, oh, yeah, I'm not in. You can go straight to that website and learn right now for free.
Okay.
So.
All right. Well, thanks again.
Yeah.
And we will probably have you back again.
Okay. I love it. I love it. It's the Faith Connection Show, and it's here to help you grow. It's the Faith Connection. It's here to help you grow. It's the Faith Connection Show. And it's here to help you grow. Here we go, here we go, here we go. Here we go, here we go, here we go. It's the Faith Connection Show. It's the Faith Connection Show. It's giving you motivation, inspiration, revelation. It's giving you motivation, inspiration, revelation. It's the Faith Connection. Here we go, here we go, here we go.
Here we go, here we go, here we go.
Here's the inspirational word from Dr. David Miller before the show begins.
There are a lot of storms in life. There are financial storms, marital storms, relationship storms, and you're saying in the midst of your storm, where is God? Well, the storm is not there to remind us of the absence of God, but the storm is there to remind us of the need for God. Let God speak into your storm, and he will say, peace, be still.
It's the Faith Connection.
We have in the studio with us Dr. Honey Spencer, MD, and we're very glad to have you with us, Dr. Spencer. We look forward to having a great show with you today. Well, Dr. Spencer, tell us a little bit about yourself. I know that you are in both private practice because you own a plastic surgery center, and you also work as a critical care doctor or physician. And so you get it from both ends of the spectrum. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Dr. Spencer. The listeners would love to hear a little bit about you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Miller. My name is Dr. Honey Spencer, as you mentioned. I'm originally from a very small island in the Eastern Caribbean called Antigua. I moved to the United States in 1986, so it's been about 32 years since I've been living here, and I'm a U.S. citizen.
Yeah.
I attended college and actually initially wanted to be a professional concert pianist, but in my first year at college, I made the decision to go to medical school because I always had an interest in the sciences and was very curious about the body and how it worked. And I thought that pursuing medicine would be the best in that I could still continue practicing and playing, but at the same time practice as a physician. And so I attended medical school at Case Western Reserve in Cleveland, Ohio, and then trained at the University Hospitals of Cleveland and the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio. And after residency, I relocated to Concord, where I practiced family medicine and was an attending physician with CMC Northeast for approximately 13 years. During that time, I primarily worked with Cabarrus Family Medicine residency program and with the health department, and that's where I was introduced to outpatient medicine, primarily working with a lower socioeconomic aspect of the community. After working and practicing there for about 13 years, I decided to make the transition to become a hospitalist, which is pretty much a general practitioner who specializes in general medicine and takes care of patients who go to the emergency room and are diagnosed with any sort of problem that requires in hospitalization. And I've been working as a hospitalist now for the past 8 years, and during that time, I decided that I also wanted to pursue one of my favorite aspects of practicing medicine is to make people beautiful and to feel beautiful. And so I invested in the purchase of a med spa plastic surgery, and then the rest is history. That's how we got to know each other. So
fantastic. You've done a lot, and the fact that you change your major from concert pianist to a physician. I know that you have a broad background in medicine, and that's the reason I really wanted you on the show. There are a lot of questions that I think women may have about breast cancer and some of the other things that go on with it. And of course, I think we're going to enlighten a lot of men as well, because if a man's wife ends up with this terrible disease, it affects the whole family. And I had a young lady on the show last week that talked about that. And one question that I would like to pose is, after breast cancer is diagnosed, do all cases end up in mastectomies? Because I know that's a tragic thing for any woman to have to go through, because it's so much a part of her being a woman. Can you help us a little bit with that?
Sure. After breast cancer diagnosis, it does not immediately mean that the individual is going to lose a breast or both. Actually, the determination as to whether that individual with the diagnosis has mastectomy is going to be a decision that is dependent upon what is found during biopsy. So, for instance, let's say that particular individual performed a self-breast exam, found a lump, went to their doctor and obtained a mammogram and showed that there is a suspicious lesion. The next step would be a biopsy. The biopsy is then taken to the lab where a pathologist who is an expert at being able to tell what types of cancers and how aggressive the cancer is will be looked upon. And then that information will be taken to the cancer specialist, or in this case, an oncologist and a breast cancer surgeon. And they will make a determination depending upon what the tumor looks like and what they stage it as. So, for instance, there are cancers that have pretty much what we determine or call breast cancer in situ, which simply means that it has not grown outside of the breast tissue. It has not gone to any other organs in the body. And typically in situations like that, based on the size of the tumor, then it most likely would be the type of cancer that they would pursue what's called breast conservative surgery, which basically means that they try to conserve the breast. So they will only remove breast tissue that includes the tumor, but not the entire breast. And at that time, they may also determine that the cancer can be successfully eradicated completely by testing the tumor to see if there are certain hormonal responses that the tumor is part of. And then they will potentially prescribe medications by mouth so that the individual, after they've had that lumpectomy and that procedure, then they'll take this medicine that is to prevent the possibility of a recurrence. So in that particular case, the individual does not obtain mastectomy, and they're able to keep their breast and feel very comfortable in their own skin without feeling that now they've been disfigured. Mastectomy really, of course, is pretty much involved in the situations where the cancer has metastasized, and or in the decision making on an individual who has family risk factors and they've done genetic testing, and the option to have mastectomy to decrease their chances of getting breast cancer has been entertained. So at that point, they have made the decision that that's what they want. So again, it does not, the diagnosis does not immediately mean, oh, you have to have a mastectomy. There are all these other factors that are involved.
Now, for instance, if in the event that they leave the breast and they remove the tumor or the cancer, does that not increase the risk of it returning? Because I would assume, and of course, that is truly an assumption on my part, that the cells, sometimes they can escape. Does that, and that's my question, I guess, is the risk greater when they do not remove the whole breast and just remove the cancer?
Right. So if they just remove the cancer, what they do, first of all, they make very selected choices as to who they would only remove tumors and a little bit of breast tissue, which in that case is called a lumpectomy. There are other things involved in helping to reduce the possibility of recurrence. So, for instance, during that particular surgery, they may also check the glands. In the non-medical world, it's called the glands. In the medical world, they're known as lymph nodes. So what they will do is they'll also biopsy lymph nodes that are closest to the tumor, and depending upon whether there is presence of cancer cells in those lymph nodes, then they will make the determination of whether or not, maybe even at that time, they might decide to perform a mastectomy. In fact, one of the things that's done during the early stages of talking about surgery, the breast surgeon will discuss with the client that this is what we are agreeing on, but there's a potential that during the surgery, if we check one of these lymph nodes and it's positive, we may have to resort to a mastectomy. So the oncologists and the surgeons are going to do everything to provide whatever therapy it is to decrease the risk of recurrence. They will never, ever provide an option to the client that is going to increase their risk recurrence. So people who are obtaining lumpectomies typically will have what's called adjuvant therapy. Adjuvant therapy basically implies any therapy such as radiation or hormonal therapy where they take medications like tamoxifen, which is a very commonly prescribed medication, is done after surgery. And then there's also neoadjuvant, which is before surgery, that they may decide to treat the client with medications to shrink the tumor before surgery. But again, you get into a complex system of figuring out which tumors and which types of cancers you can give that as an option.
Okay, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with Dr. Honey Spencer.
It's the Faith Connection.
If it had not been for the Lord who was on my side, I don't know where I would be. Fellowship, let's go.
My testimony is real.
In the studio with us this morning, Dr. Honey Spencer, MD, and we're very glad to have you with us, Dr. Spencer. We're doing this month, the month of October, is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. I guess the real question that I want to ask, is there any particular individual that is more susceptible to not discovering that there is a lump or something if they are doing self-checks and maybe something gets by them? Because all of our anatomies are different, and that's sort of a question I have about that.
Well, self-breast exams, of course, is something that we typically encourage women. It empowers them. Statistically, though, when you review the numbers, self-breast exams actually do not measure up with getting screen and mammograms. However, in the World Health Organization, for instance, encourages women around the world to perform self-breast exams so that they can empower themselves. And to be very honest, sometimes, of course, it's the woman's breast. You know, by the time you wait for that particular individual to see the doctor only sees the individual probably once a year, especially if they're fairly healthy women. So the encouragement of self-breast exams are important.
How often should a woman do that? You think like when she's taking a shower every day or, you know, once a week or
When we taught self-breast exams and how to perform it and when to perform it, one of the things we stressed was is obviously pick a situation that is easy. So, for instance, during the typical showering, prior to showering or after showering, because, you know, we have to shower every day, or at least we hope everyone showers every day. And also to do it on a consistent basis, probably once a month. And at least if it's once a month, even if it's not the same date every month, one of the reasons that it was thought that it would be best to stick to a particular day was especially if you're dealing with women who are still menstruating and or have experience in hormonal changes. And so the breast architecture can change with hormonal change. So that was one of the reasons for trying to stay on a schedule. But going back to the original question that you were asking about whether or not some women are at risk for missing, if there are any particular situations that that can occur. And certainly I would say that in situations where the breasts are very large, sometimes it might be difficult for the individual to be able to feel a particular abnormality or mass in the breast, especially if they're doing it in one particular position, because lying down, sitting up, the breast will take on a different position.
So that means that women who are a bit larger, would it be much more imperative that they would have their mammograms on a more frequent basis?
I would not say it's necessarily more frequent, but they definitely would be encouraged to get a mammogram for this as a screening tool. The mammogram still, from a statistical method, is the number one screening agent that promotes and finds most of the abnormal lesions that subsequently become diagnosed as breast cancer. So,
okay. The other question I have for you, Dr. Spencer, is you say once a year maybe for the mammograms. Would it hurt anything to have it more regular, or especially for women who are have higher risk factors? Would you think it would be imperative that they do it a little bit more often?
Actually, I want to make a quick correction. The recommendation for screening is actually every 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Your question is if someone with risk factors, so for instance, family history, or if they're genetically tested, and or if they are diagnosed with breast cancer, should they get screened more quickly? And actually, they are recommending that they get screened once a year with other modalities, including not just a mammogram, but perhaps ultrasound and MRI, mm-hmm. which are other types of diagnostic studies available. And of course, there are screening systems that have been created by committees such as the American Joint Committee on Cancer Screening for Breast, and they have actually come up with a particular recommendation as to various categories. You've got categories of women based on age and risk factors. So, for instance, someone less than 40 years of age who do not have family history, there's a recommendation as to no screening, because the problem with screening, especially if you don't have risk factors, you can obtain what's called false positive results, which lead to potential spending for a surgery that's not actually, there's no reason to do that because the individual didn't really have breast cancer. It was a false positive test. All diagnostic studies tend to have potentially results where you can have a false positive, meaning it's saying that there is a problem, but really there is not. And so that's the risk you run.
How often does that occur?
It depends on the test itself, and they actually do have values that they will give. Sometimes less than 1% of the times that you can have diagnostic studies providing you with information that's not actually correct. Mm. And that's the trade-off and the harm that you risk if you screen too often and or select an individual who really does not have the risk factors to screen. That's potential
scary
problem. Yes.
You mentioned something a moment ago about hormonal changes. Does that increase the risk for breast cancer?
No, it doesn't. That was really primarily related to the self-breast exam, especially in individuals who are still having cycles. Mm-hmm. But most individuals, between mid-40s and above, tend not to have cycles at that point. So the hormonal changes to the breast architecture is not even an issue.
Now, breast cancer is the second leading cause of all types of cancer in women in the U.S. Mm-hmm. It seems like a country like our country, there's so much medical technology to draw from, and women are so aware of these forms of uterine cancer and other forms of cancer. Why would breast cancer be such a high-risk area?
Great question. We're still trying to figure that out as well. Of course, there are so many things that we're finding as doctors and within the last 10 years that we never thought would be a cause for certain types of cancers. And with breast cancer, the issue is, are there environmental toxins that women are being exposed to in this part of the world that somehow has anything to do with it? We know that there is an association with ethnicities. We know that there is an association, obviously, with genetics. But the question is, are there environmental toxins that are associated with breast cancer? Is there, what other factors could be out there that's causing this? We frankly don't know. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a million-dollar question.
Okay, and African-American women have the highest risk of breast cancer, and they attribute it to several areas, social, economic conditions, different things. And I guess my question is there more being done in that area with African-American women in order to tighten the lines of disparity between other groups?
Yeah, I think that from my recollection, when I was working in outpatient medicine, one of the things that was going on, especially with the health department, they were actively working on various programs for women, African-American women, especially so that they can get the access they need. Because, of course, one of the, at least I would say, the most important problem that African-American women were having was access financially, access with transportation. And for a lot of them, too, it was just basic education, not really knowing all the details and simple things that they could do and programs that were out there that they were qualified to receive. So, yes, I do think that there have been a lot of grassroots organizations working diligently to try to get this disparity and eradicate it, to get the word out, to educate clients in neighborhoods specifically that are lower socioeconomic neighborhoods, similar to the one that I worked in, so that African-American women would not be singled out in this particular disease process.
Now, I spoke with Dr. Kirsch. He's a surgeon at your clinic, about coming on the show and talking about reconstruction and that kind of thing. But there's a question I'd like to ask you. When a woman has a mastectomy and they're associated with that is a lot of emotional changes, do you all recommend that they have some form of counseling before having any kind of reconstructive surgery done?
Most of the oncologists and breast surgeons actually do provide that counseling to women who are considering reconstructive surgery. Of course, as you said, it's very emotionally devastating, and most women want to have some sort of surgical reconstruction of the breasts. There are some women who are quite comfortable and do not care about having to have reconstructive breast surgery and wear prostheses. But most women, I would say, do want to have some sort of feeling back to normal. Mm-hmm. And so the approach is a multidisciplinary approach, which includes counseling prior to and during the conversation as to the options as to how to pursue that reconstructive surgery.
Mm. Okay. Now, in your clinic, you actually perform breast augmentations and a bunch of other procedures as well. So would your clinic perhaps would not do reconstructive because there is a greater risk, I would assume, in that. Is that correct or not correct?
Well, what we primarily work on is not reconstructive surgery. It's basically this is the typical surgeries we're performing are for enhancement purposes. Mm-hmm. And the services are pretty much elective in that this is what a patient or an individual wants for themselves, as opposed to this is reacting to a diagnosis of cancer and having had surgery to remove the breasts. So in cases of reconstructive surgery, I certainly would lead the client to their oncologist or cancer doctor and breast surgeons in that capacity, because the other thing that's important is that typically insurance companies are involved who pay for that particular service. And when it's a medically selected procedure, then that's really typically done in the hospital as opposed to going to an outpatient surgery setting for elective surgery. And mm-hmm. so that's the difference with our structure compared to the hospital.
Okay. I'm going to have you back on the show again so that we can talk about your clinic and the services you offer. And I would really love to have you back when I bring Dr. Kirsch on, because yes. I can get cross-section of comments about what women are going through. Do you have any last words that you would like to share with us? Any comments?
Well, with regards to breast cancer, of course, the word cancer somehow is very devastating to hear that word, because the first thing that anyone thinks about cancer equates to dying or death. The good news is that over the last 20 years, we have made so many advances in the treatment of cancer and specifically breast cancer. And we are seeing so many women who have survived and are doing very well. Of course, we are still working feverishly to eliminate it and eradicate it. We have new tools from genetic testing, new diagnostic modalities. So we feel that we have made lots of strides. We are continuing to make more strides. And I just want to encourage women who receive this diagnosis not to fear, not to get overly anxious, but to remain positive as best as they can, because there are so many options now that we have that we didn't have many years ago. And so I just want people to be encouraged and not discouraged.
Fantastic. So really, knowledge is power. Thank you so much, Dr. Spencer, for coming. And you've added a lot to our show today. And certainly your knowledge is just unbelievable about
this area.
And I think we've made the connection today. And I'm sure our listeners have gleaned something from this conversation. All right.
Thank you very
much. Thank you so much.
It's the Faith Connection Show. It's the Faith Connection Show, and it's here to help you grow. Here we go, here we go, here we go. Here we go, here we go, here we go. It's the Faith Connection Show. It's the Faith Connection Show. It's giving you motivation, inspiration, revelation. It's giving you motivation, inspiration, revelation. It's the Faith Connection.